Let's start with a game. Don't, do not think of a pink elephant. And now you're picturing one, right? And that's called ironic process theory. The harder we try not to think about something, the more we do. Politicians know this, and when they want to avoid people imagining the downside of a policy, they usually keep it vague. Not Friedrich Merz. Ahead of this week's EU summit in Brussels, Germany's chancellor did the opposite. He raised the stakes sky high. And now the summit is over, and while the results aren't a disaster, they do fall short of what Merz said was on the line. Russia is mocking him, and his credibility, some people say, is on the line. So why did he take that risk? This is the Berlin-Brussels briefing. We'll hear from two journalists who know Merz best to unpack what drives him and what this week revealed about his leadership. So let's start with Dan Goffert, who writes for Wirtschaftswoche, is in Brussels, followed the EU summit this week, and has written a biography about Friedrich Merz. Dan, can you just give us a summary of what the major decisions were that were taken at the summit in Brussels?
Yeah, the major decision was that Europe is still able and willing to save Ukraine, to spend 90 billion euros to help them in the next 2 years. And what didn't pass, it was the idea of Friedrich Merz to use the frozen Russian assets, which are in Brussels with the company Euroclear. That didn't work. But on the other hand, Brussels was able, or the EU was able, to find a solution in this very, very challenging situation, because in a few weeks, Ukraine is running out of money and they desperately need some. And from this aspect, the result of the summit was okay. Not great, but okay.
The other decision was, of course, to postpone the signatures under the Mercosur trade agreement with Latin American countries. And that is something, and I want to bring in Michaela Kufner here, our chief political editor, who's here with me in the studio. Michaela, that is something where Friedrich Merz made some very, very big statements ahead of this summit, and that didn't get delivered.
It didn't, because the Italians say they need more time. And both issues, the Mercosur and Ukraine, are not just about money. They're also about the credibility of the European Union to be a meaningful actor geopolitically. It's about the credibility also particularly with the United States. The Europeans are under pressure from the United States. The latest national security strategy highlights that the Americans would like to see individual nation states rather than an EU that acts united. And in Ukraine, the EU is somewhat acting united, but it's failing to really show the Russians that they are willing to take a risk and tap into their money. And the reaction we've seen out of Russia, which is positive, already proves the point that the Europeans didn't manage to really show the Russians that they can act. And Friedrich Merz himself is now asking the question whether that decision, they found the money, that's not the problem, they found the 90 billion for now, but whether there's enough pressure on Russia to get Russia to the negotiating table. So this poses a huge problem, and Friedrich Merz was the one who put Europeans under pressure. I was in Parliament here when he always holds this address to Parliament ahead of an EU summit. And he clearly addressed his fellow leaders saying, we need to get this done. We need to prove that the EU can act when it gets serious. And we need to put pressure on Russia. And this clearly didn't happen.
No, because essentially European countries are footing the bill for Ukraine. Ukraine funding is secure for another 2 years, but it's not being paid for by Russia. But Friedrich Merz took to the media, addressed journalists after the summit was over, and sold the results as a success. Nonetheless, let's just listen to what he said.
Europe has understood what is at stake and has demonstrated its sovereignty. We are resolutely confronting the greatest threat to Europe's security. That threat is Russia's aggression, which has long gone beyond its war against Ukraine. Today we have decided that funding will be guaranteed for several years, as I called for in October of this year. This multi-year perspective is crucial to securing Ukraine's future, but also to sending a clear signal to Moscow.
So, Dan, over in Brussels, what is the signal to Moscow right now, coming out of this summit and from Friedrich Merz?
Yes, in this way he's right, I think, because the signal is, okay, we go on helping Ukraine, we go on give the money to them. 90 billion euros is less than expected, but it's not nothing. So they can go on for the next time. And the signal to Putin is, of course, don't believe that we will stop to help Ukraine. Don't believe that you can do what you want there, because the European countries will not find a solution in a very challenging situation. They did find a solution. They did not follow the original idea of Friedrich Merz, who had asked the other leaders to take the Russian frozen assets, to send them over to the Ukraine, to make a legal risk being in changing the assets into reparation loan. But at the end, the most important thing is there was a solution, there is money for Ukraine, and they are not running out of help from the Europeans.
Can you, just for our viewers who may be watching or listening from, say, Washington or from San Francisco, can you just sum up again, why did European leaders not agree to use frozen Russian assets and make the aggressor pay for reconstruction in Ukraine and for funding that Ukraine needs over the next 2 years?
Yeah, the problem is that they've, especially Belgium, where this company Euroclear is working, they fear that they have to pay damage repairs, and they don't want to take these legal risks. Belgium is a small country. We are talking about 210 billion euros in total for the Russian frozen assets, and they don't want to take this risk alone on their shoulders. That's understandable. And so the idea from Friedrich Merz was, okay, let's take this money, change it from the assets into a reparation loan. This loan should be paid back by Ukraine if Russia will pay reparation after the war. If they don't do so, they don't need to pay it back. So there is, of course, in this legal construction, there is a risk. Maybe if you go to international court, they will not agree with that. But the idea was that the European countries share that risk. The problem is that they were not willing to share that risk, especially not only small countries like Belgium, but even major countries like Italy and France. And that was, from my perspective, the biggest problem in this result of this summit. Countries like Italy, countries like France, they were not willing to show European solidarity in a situation where we really have to need solidarity in Europe more than before.
And it wasn't just legal concerns, right? I mean, the Belgian leader said that he received personal threats from Moscow, Michaela.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't, want to see this portrayed as him giving in to personal threats, but clearly he was very concerned about the financial risks that could hit his country. There was a threat by Russia to then launch direct attacks. This doesn't mean missiles, it could potentially mean drones, but to really put pressure on Belgium. And Belgium, to an extent, didn't feel that it got the reassurances that it would have needed from the other partners. But this is about so much more than how the financing is structured for Ukraine. This is much about whether the Europeans will actually continue to have a seat at the table. Merz can rightly claim for himself that he brought the Americans over here to Berlin over the last days leading up to this summit. He got Jared Kushner here, Steve Witkoff, Jared Kushner, the son-in-law of US President Donald Trump, Witkoff being the special envoy, first on the Middle East, in parallel on Ukraine as well. And they all sat down and worked on what is now believed to be a 20-point plan, which originally was this 28-point plan that so shocked the Europeans that many felt had been partly written by Russia. He managed to get them all around the table. He managed to get the Americans to put into writing, as far as we know, but we haven't seen this writing yet, to offer Ukraine meaningful security guarantees, Article 5-like. What the German people, negotiators who briefed us, don't like to talk about is how large the interest of the Americans is in exactly those $210 billion in Russian assets. In the original 28-point plan, there was a provision that would see the Americans indirectly getting a share of this. Clearly, business interests are driving the interest the Americans have to have the Europeans sitting at the table. So what have the Europeans now delivered? They are guaranteeing the funding for Ukraine. But when Witkoff now sits down with the Russian side in Florida, the Russians, who are welcoming what just came out of the EU summit because it shied away from directly tapping into this Russian money, they can rightly claim for themselves, saying, look, when it gets serious, the Europeans are to some degree chickening out. And this also means that the United States will not be able to benefit from this money itself. So the interest in having the Europeans at the table could somewhat wane on the American side. And that would be a catastrophe geopolitically for the Europeans. So my argument would be, yes, the Europeans found a very European solution and compromise, but they failed to live up to this moment. And that's exactly what Friedrich Merz had demanded. And this is his style, not saying, OK, let's see what's doable, but saying this is where we need to get to. And that's what he did. And now he suffers to some degree in terms of credibility because he didn't manage to get his European partners, particularly Belgium, but also several others, the Italians notably as well, to sign off on actually getting serious in tapping into that Russian money.
And I think the issue that we do need to talk about here is that he personally got invested. He didn't send his counselors. He himself changed his travel plans. He was going to go abroad and then last minute said, no, I've got to see the Belgian prime minister and sit down with him and the head of the European Commission for an informal dinner. No journalists were taken. This was seriously Friedrich Merz trying to convince Bartha Weber of his own ideas.
On Living Planet, we've got questions.
Is anyone trying to clean up this mess?
Big questions.
Should we really be sinking our money into this?
Questions that get to the bottom of things.
How much CO2 does a tree absorb anyway?
Your questions.
How often do you think we should use the reusable cups to compensate for the paper ones?
But don't worry, we've got answers too. Answers to help you navigate some of the biggest environmental issues of our time.
That's on Living Planet.
Find us wherever you get podcasts.
Dan, why did Friedrich Merz surprise so many people that he got invested himself personally, puts his own credibility on the line, links his own political image essentially to this make or break question? What, you've observed him for years. Why? What drives him there?
He's driven by his opinion that you need leadership in Europe if you have 27 different countries and you go to the summit without any idea, without any concrete proposal, you will not reach anything. So his idea was, I do make a proposal, which that one can follow, and he hoped that they did. And it was 50-50, but at the end, the problem in my eyes is not that the chancellor made a proposal. The problem is that the European countries were not willing to show solidarity. That's the main problem in my eyes. And what about the question how Europe can sit on the table in further talks with Russia and the US, as long as they have their hand on the frozen assets and they will keep frozen until the war ends, they are sitting on the table because, like Michaela said before, the Americans are calculating with this $200 billion because they want to build a recovery fund. They want to make business in the reconstruction of Ukraine after a war. And without the money, they hardly can do it. So the decision to take this frozen assets for a long time and not allow Russia to to lay their hand on it, that was the guarantee for the Europeans to take place on the table. And this option is still there. It's not gone with the result of this summit. It could be a better result in my eyes as well, that's right, but you have to see 27 countries, three East European countries, Hungary, Czech Republic and Slovakia. They are close to Vladimir Putin. They are very much influenced from Russia. They don't help the Europeans. And for me, the most disappointing thing was that Italy and France stand not on the side of the Western countries. So, but Friedrich Merz, I think it's his style. He tries to find a solution. He tries to get forward. He tries to convince people. That is his style. It's perhaps not every time successful, but my opinion, if you try to take leadership in Europe, you need concrete ideas, you need proposals, and what you don't need is to go in and to look what the majority perhaps wants. You have to make the proposals before, and you have to find allies in the talks. That's my opinion to that, and that's the style of Friedrich Merz.
The issue here now, of course, is that now it will require another political decision to then seriously tap into these Russian assets. And this decision could have been taken here and now, which would have demonstrated the willingness of the EU to act. That consensus simply isn't there. The Viktor Orban of Hungary, the prime minister, method kind of got the upper hand. Viktor Orban himself labeled agreeing on that proposal that Friedrich Merz pushed so hard, that would mean a war with Russia. So he is taking on the Russian rhetoric here. At the same time, he could have blocked the plan B that was now decided, and he shied away from that as well. So you have a key European leader oscillating on that line between Russia and the EU itself. That is an issue that Friedrich Merz has to deal with. But I just want to highlight the difference between the Merkel-esque approach to politics.
I was going to ask you about that.
Because
and Olaf Scholz, of course.
Yes, there are fundamental differences. Angela Merkel would have gone into a situation like this already having mapped out potential ways of getting there, but she would have shied away from calling on EU leaders. This is exactly what we need to decide on. And this is why it now...
From linking it to her own political image, essentially, and destiny.
Yes. And then Olaf Scholz essentially would never really talk of a political solution unless he was almost already there, which kept him from putting a lot of proposals on the table. And Friedrich Merz, you know, you can tell that he wasn't in politics for a very long time. He takes very much a CEO approach to politics, and he is unafraid in labeling or speaking out clearly where he says everybody needs to get to. And that's why we can then trace the EU leaders not having gotten to that point. So now he's still selling this as a success, as he has to. He has to be a good sport. But what remains on the record is that he really felt the necessity, not just the desire, the necessity for the EU to be much more decisive. And he entered his tenure as German Chancellor. He's been there for more than 7 months now. I just want to remind us all, with this rather dramatic trip to Kiev, together with Keir Starmer, with Donald Tusk, with Emmanuel Macron, where they then got Trump on the phone. And the agreement there and the necessity then, which became very public, was to have a ceasefire within a couple of days. And then they were let down by Donald Trump. So he's been in this situation before where he's building up to a key moment and then it fails to come through. So he remains unafraid of putting his credibility on the line, and also domestically, we've spoken about the pension and everything. And the question here is, how often can you do that without losing credibility, even if you are the leader of the third largest economy and the most important economy within the European Union? So I think this is the damage for him personally coming home from this EU summit.
And why take that risk? Why is he so personally invested in the issue of supporting Ukraine? There are lots of voices in many European countries these days that say, look, this is not our country. Why are European taxpayers footing the bill to help a country defend itself against aggression. What has this war got to do with us?
So well, I want
to
just a short answer.
Yeah.
He gave it in Parliament himself.
Yeah.
Saying Ukraine's security is Europe's security, and he's more adamant and more clear in his communication there than any previous leader.
Exactly. So, Dan, you know, I want to ask you about Friedrich Merz's political convictions. They seem to be emotional as well as, you know, ideological, and not necessarily in this day and age strategic. The way he acts on the international stage, he is very much driven by this very firm belief that we're talking about questions of war and peace in our own country, in Germany as well, right?
Not, I don't agree in that way, really not. What did the summit show? The summit showed that the European countries don't want to pay a lot of money for Ukraine. Because if you see some northern countries, especially Germany and Poland, they have sending money and cash to Kiev, billions of money in the last years, and the other one don't do so. And what Friedrich Merz was trying is say, okay, Fox, we have a really severe problem, because if we don't save Ukraine, our security will be damaged as well. That's something you should see. And the closer you are to Ukraine, I think the clearer you can see the position of the Baltic countries, of Poland and of Germany. And of course, this is another point of view than you have in Spain or in Italy or my way in France. On the other hand, France was the partner of Germany for centuries in Europe, in leading Europe. And we have the problem in France, especially, that there is ongoing government crisis since 2 years. The president, Emmanuel Macron, is very weak now. He can't do anything in France. Every decision he made is unclear, is unstable. He has to ask the parliament. He has a lot of problems because he has no majority in the parliament. In that situation, I think Friedrich Merz was, he felt responsibility for finding a solution. Of course, there's always a risk. If you go ahead and if you say, okay, I will try to convince the other one, and if you are not successful, you have a problem. That's right. That's what you say. On the other hand, what is the alternative? Is the alternative to say, okay, I make a telephone call before to all the other leaders, and when I see, okay, they don't want, I leave it. So that, for me, that's not politics, not leading politics in a very difficult situation in Europe with, as I said, 27 different countries. And if you see the next point, the money is very important for that. It's not only because the US want to manage this recovery fund and to guarantee 50% of all profits which will come out on the reconstruction work in Ukraine. The main problem is how long Ukraine can withstand the Russian aggression. And for this, they need money, they need weapons, they need soldiers, they need help, and they need the signal from the European countries to Russia, don't believe we are let them down. We don't let them down. We struggle hard to convince the other ones, that's right, and not every attempt is successful, that's right as well, but we don't let them down. That is the most important signal, and this signal was coming out of this summit in Brussels today.
The EU won't let Ukraine down financially. That signal is clear, but it shied away from standing up to Russia. And this has been noted in Washington. And this will most likely have an impact on those talks that are taking place between the US and Russian negotiators. And the Europeans should be very concerned about that. And Friedrich Merz didn't shy away from making this gap visible. Other leaders probably wouldn't have been so, you can almost say, reckless now to make this now so visible by demanding from his EU partners to play ball on tapping into the Russian assets. So now there potentially is this credibility gap, and the damage has been done. And Mercosur, just to come back with the trade agreement with Latin American countries, if that falls flat in the next 2 weeks that the Italians now say they need an extra time, that would be yet more proof that the EU simply can't get key strategic decisions done. And this is a huge issue, not just for Friedrich Merz's leadership, but for the Europeans as a whole. And it's true what you just said, Dan. The closer countries are to Russia, the more alarmed they are. Donald Tusk, the Polish prime minister, said it was either the money now or
blood later.
Blood later.
European blood.
And he, we know that he's not afraid of using dramatic language on this. And then you have Viktor Orban, the other end of the spectrum, interestingly, playing this dance with Russia and his EU membership, saying that tapping into these assets would have meant actually being at war with Russia. And that's the spectrum. You're not going to get these sides together. But you need to prove that the EU can act. And certainly Friedrich Merz is feeling that pain very much.
And I want to ask both of you, did he promise too much this week? Can Washington and Russia now say, well, look, the Europeans didn't get it together again? Or is there something where you would say Friedrich Merz's leadership style has helped the European Union this week? Dan, I'll start with you.
I don't think that he promised something. He made a proposal. And from the very first moment on, he said, OK, there are some concerns about my proposal. There are some resistance. There are some problems to solve, especially in Belgium. He didn't promise anything, but he made a proposal. And he has an idea. And this idea didn't work fully. It worked half because the idea to send money to Ukraine was working. But what is the alternative? That's my question, and is this way. Okay, we can talk about the style of Friedrich Merz, his leading, his management of expectations, all the thing that's right. And of course, he was not successful to 100%, but I think the alternative could not be that you don't do anything, especially in a situation when the other leader in the German Franco tandem, Emmanuel Macron, is not able to do anything anymore. So the signal to Washington as to Moscow is that there is a lot of problems in solidarity in Europe, that it's not very hard to split them because the Americans try to convince some European countries not to use the frozen assets because they have other ideas what to do with the frozen assets. That's true. But on the other hand, there was a result and a majority for this result, and the help for Kyiv is going on. That is the most important thing. And that is the signal to Russia and the signal to the US as well, that the Europeans are still in the game and they are still on the table.
Michaela, what's your assessment of Friedrich Merz's leadership at the moment? What have we learned?
I think we learned that he's unafraid to expose the difference between what he perceives to be a political necessity and what is the politically doable. And that has now been exposed for everyone to see. And that's why the inner European divisions are becoming very apparent. And if you look at him domestically as well, he is burning his own credibility in terms of promises like there's no tomorrow, one can argue, because his opinion polls, it's like an all-time low of this government. He has a lot of reform projects that he promised, but that he partly hasn't even started properly, just looking at the whole issue of pensions. He's postponed them into next year, and he keeps making bold statements over what needs to happen, where Germany needs to get from his leadership perspective. And he's learning the hard way time and time again that what is politically doable falls short of that. So, you know, it's up to the public, we're in democracies, to decide whether they would rather hear about what their elected leader feels where the country needs to get to and then see him fall short of that, or whether he would rather take, let's say, a Merkel-esque approach of saying this is what is doable, and that's how we get there. And Merkel famously said at one of her final press conferences, I asked her what she regretted in terms of what she didn't get done. And she said, particularly on climate, she felt more could have been done, but she couldn't find the majorities. And Friedrich Merz clearly is in the game of trying to create majorities. And this clearly is proving a very tough grind for him. But I don't really see him stopping trying to do that.
And this sums up, or this brings us to the beginning of how I started this podcast so nicely, as if we'd talked about this, Michaela, because Angela Merkel would never have mentioned a pink elephant. And Friedrich Merz does do that. But we're going to be back next week with another episode of Berlin Briefing. And of course, Michaela and I will also start the new year with an outlook on what's to come in terms of German debates and the view from Germany on international topics. And there are a lot of things to talk about. So thank you very much for watching for today. And make sure that you subscribe to Berlin Briefing wherever you find us.